91.3 KXCI Tucson. Real people, real radio.
Good afternoon, Tucson, and thanks for joining us today at 91.3 KXCI, Tucson's community radio, where we have real people and real radio. This is Aspen Green with my co-host, Kathy Harris, and we are bringing you Broad Perspectives Radio, a program by women, about women, but for everyone. You can learn more on our Broad Perspectives Radio page at kxci.org. Today's show is with the esteemed Dr. Hideko Tamura Snyder, who calls herself Tammy. That makes it easier for us. Hiroshima survivor, who is working toward peace and nuclear non-proliferation. Her story is so powerful, as well as her message. So over to you, Kathy.
Okay, and I cannot say how delighted we are to have Hideko Tamura Snyder here, or Tammy, as you said. That makes it much easier. Tammy was a child in Hiroshima when the city was destroyed by the atomic bomb. She later came to the U.S. and earned her BA in sociology and an MA in social work from the University of Chicago. She worked in adoption and foster care for the Chicago Child Care Society, supervised in adult psychiatry at Northwestern University Medical School, and was responsible for social work support for the Radiation Oncology Department of the University of Chicago Hospitals. She also maintained a private practice in psychotherapy and in cross-cultural communications for the business community. She's now retired in Southern Oregon. She's lectured extensively in the United States and in the UK about the consequences of nuclear weapons and to promote peace. She founded and chairs the nonprofit organization One Sunny Day Initiatives, or OSDI, promoting peace, hope, and reconciliation while working toward a world free of nuclear weapons. Tammy was awarded an honorary doctorate in humane letters by Worcester College, was named Peace Ambassador for the city of Hiroshima, and received the Peacekeeper Award from Ashland, Oregon's Peace House. Her publications, among others, include the books When a Peace Tree Blooms and One Sunny Day, A Child's Memories of Hiroshima. Tammy, welcome to our show.
Thank you so much. It's such a privilege to be with you.
Well, the privilege is ours for sure. And let me just start by saying, on August 6th of 1945, the United States detonated an atomic bomb over Hiroshima, and 3 days later, another one over Nagasaki. The bombings killed between 109 and 226,000 people. Tammy, you were only 10 years old and were in Hiroshima the day the bomb dropped there. If you don't mind, I'd like to read from the first paragraph of the introduction to your book, One Sunny Day, which is about your experiences on that day and the rest of your life, too. But you start out by saying, every year when the days begin to stretch and the penetrating heat of summer rises to a scorching point, I am brought back to the one sunny day in a faraway land. I was a young child waiting for my mother to come home. On that day, however, the sun and the earth melted together. My mother would not come home. You know, that brings tears to my eyes, even just reading that. Can you share with us a little of what you experienced that day, Tammy?
Let me tell you right away, it's just like yesterday, 70-some years later. It has never, ever become remote. I can feel that day when I was so happy. I managed to persuade my mother, and my best friend did the same with her mom. We can't stand being in this evacuation. There's no food. We both came from fairly well-off families, so that we knew if we went home, we'll have no problem. What did I do? What did I do? We came home in the evening of August 5th. I was so happy. Oh, we managed to come home. Beautiful morning. The birds were chirping. The sun was shining. I thought that was the happiest day of my life. And that was 7:30 in the morning on August 6th. Had I known what was to happen, I would never have come home. If I starved to death, I would never come home. So this grief of regret I carried all my life. And my mother never came home. I'm sorry. Did a few other people I loved. The best friend I came home, she was burned to death under the house.
Could you see the explosion from where you were?
My room was open with a sliding door. So there was lots of light coming. And I was sitting against the ledge, looking at the book my cousin Hideyuki had given me. So I was starting to read. And my mother, I saw her at the end of the long hallway. She said, "I'll see you at lunchtime." "Okay, Mom, hurry home." That was the last time I saw her. But believe me, after I realized she wasn't coming home, and after my dad came home with a bunch of cremated ashes that he found after a neighbor told him where my mother was last seen, which was in the area of Ground Zero. I said, "No, Dad, my mother's not in that little handkerchief. She's somewhere. She's coming home. She did not turn into that little ash." And I more or less maintained that attitude because I would not have survived the bombing. I would not survive any of it. Has she not given me strict instructions what to do if the bomb came and dropped the direct bomb on our estate, what I had to do? Her experience of having lived through a Tokyo earthquake when she was a youngster gave her the knowledge, once you are under the debris, you have to get away from under immediately. Otherwise, you'll be burned to death, which happened to most of the people. But she also told me what to do if the house started to break and come on down. She told me, be placing yourself in a small space between firm, hard furniture, and then cover your head. And then after the destruction stops, go seek to the water. Hiroshima had seven river tributaries, and so you could find riverbank and water very easily. I was just shocked and completely frightened, I'm sure. I knew exactly what to do from one moment to the other. While the Tamra family, the chairman of the multinational corporation that the family was heading, came home with a huge glass stuck in the middle of his throat. And he sat at the back entrance on the concrete. He said, "The world has come to an end. This is the end of us all." And then all his body had pieces of glasses all over. And they just carried him to the middle of the garden and they sat there, wouldn't move. Anytime I scream, "Uncle, aunt, everybody, we got to get away from here." The factory across the street, boom, went in. There was another explosion. And the whole block was covered with fire. But within 3.5 minutes, the heat of the radiation that melted steel was starting fire everywhere. After I shouted and screamed and begged, and they wouldn't move, I decided to be faithful to my mother's instruction. You got to get away from the fire and go to the river, and which is what I did. So in a sense, I was not a completely lost child, ready to sit down and cry. I don't know what to do. I knew exactly what to do, thanks to my mom.
How amazing that your mother knew to warn you what to do in case something like that would happen. And it did save your life. Unfortunately, you did lose your mother, some family, some very close friends. And also because of the radiation, you were sick for a long time afterwards, weren't you?
First, I was covered with boils all over. It followed shortly thereafter. My hair started to fall off. And then incredibly high fever that lasted like a couple of weeks. I was picked up from the little farmer who went into town and then found out where the Tamil relations managed to go small mountain top where the wealthy farmer had a large house, and we were allowed to stay in part of his place. The man who was like a personal secretary to my uncle, if it hadn't for him, all of them would have died. Actually, my father, I didn't know, but who was in command at the naval port of Hiroshima, was sending these rescue trucks out.
There was so much destruction in your health, even though you lived, it took you a while to regain your health, as many, many people, of course. It's a very controversial thing. There are people who say that dropping these bombs ultimately saved lives because more people would have been killed if the war had gone on. What do you say to those people?
I'm sorry, I developed this laughing anytime that, you know, something hits me a little bit odd, I start laughing. And probably that's why I survived this long without dying with cancer, which most survivors do. The reason I'm laughing is that how can you make a proposition like that? It's impossible to prove or present evidence. The citizens of Japan under military fascism were taught, and of course, men were gone out of most of our household. What were left were teenagers, if there were boys. And incidentally, that's who you killed at ground zero. Middle school kids were gathered to help make a fire lane because there were so many empty houses. How are you going to prove whose lives would have been saved? I think that's a very preposterous suggestion, something that cannot be proven in any way possible.
Well, after you moved to the United States, where you came here to go to college, you eventually started the One Sunny Day Initiatives, or OSDF, which is a nonprofit organization that you founded. Tell us about that. What is the mission of that organization?
The mission of this organization, One Sunny Day, from the very start, nuclear disarmament, long, long before United Nations, I really believe world without nuclear weapon is very, very desirable. I wrote fairy stories about it, titled When the Peace Tree Blooms, and I did lots of things to bring about. I didn't just sit, you know, in some corner of the library. I believe in peace. I really do. No, no, no. Everything I thought that we need to see happen, I tried everything I could in my power so that it could possibly come someday to be true. I was very encouraged by the first democratically elected Czechoslovakian president, Václav Havel. He came to Hiroshima receiving Freedom Award, and he spoke of, if you have a hope or wish, don't stay standing there and then talking about it just like a light tower. But if you want to really see what you believe happen, you have to do something. Your conviction can't stay as just words. You have to act on it, and you have to start doing things. That really changed me to doing things. You know, although since I was a kid, I always acted. You know, I got stung by a bee because I walked in my Japanese sandal and learned the bee sting. However, I wouldn't have even thought about making this, but I took a bunch of American peace-loving folks who love to sing peace songs in town close to mine called Ashland. I like to sing, you know, my mother and I used to sing. And one day, the director, it was 2004, in the winter, started to dance all over the stage, singing South African marching song they used to sing during apartheid called Siyahamba. You know, he could Siyahamba. He was into it so 100%. And then I didn't realize, but I noticed my cheeks got totally wet. I was just weeping and weeping. And I thought to myself, gee, I want my Japanese friends in Japan to see they are not warmongers. They are peace-loving people. And if I could have taken this bunch of people doing the same thing, I would be so happy. So I called a relative who is a chorus in Japan, and then I asked him, how can I do this? I want to. She said, do you have money? I said, no. What kind of money? Well, at least 150,000 to rent a music hall for you to come and sing. Are you kidding? Nobody's going to lend any hand like that. Just sort of like so childlike wish and so forth. The another thing I want you to know is that my ideas out somewhere else, but I don't give up. I never give up. Once I think this is a great idea. So I never gave up until I found the source. And you know what? Unlike my relative who was a chorus member, she said, oh, sure. I'll help you, she said. She was my friend. So you see the truth of it. Your friend will always support whatever that means so much to you. All of these things came together, and we didn't have to do anything when we had a joint concert with this nationally top-class singing group, and we sang with them because it was their hall to sing with.
Okay, so how this concert helped to promote your goal of bringing peace to the world?
What I'm trying to tell you is that because I just wouldn't give up, I, in 2005, went to Japan, spent my own pocket money for travel and lodging and everything. In 2006, I took the Americans Peace Choir, and then we sang all over. And honestly, Japanese people don't show emotion right away. They're pretty sort of like a reserve. We sang, we showed them how to show emotion. We shall overcome. And at the end of it, we held hands together and put it all at the top. And so they followed our example. And I think they found themselves being very emotional. And they were so delighted and elated. It was a top sense of liberation and believing in peace. I can help you do that. That's one of my pleasures. So that's what happened all over. We shall overcome. I have it in YouTube at that very moment. It's just an incredible experience. I've taken people to incredible experiences so many times because I feel very genuine. And then, like Havel said, if you really believe in it, you act on it. And then I act on it. And if people said, you can't do it, I think to myself, watch me. I'm not going to give up. That's the second
Okay.
word. Watch me. And I will just keep on doing so. I made it happen 2 years later. How does this connect with OSDI? They insisted on paying me back all my expenses. I just put myself 200% to translate what kind of people everyone was. Besides the picture, behind it was the resume and their peace message. I stayed up losing my sleep, translating everything I could possibly say about each person. 38 people went there. That was a lot of work. And translating everything. I did it for my pleasure, nothing else. So you don't need to pay me this thing. And they said, well, we're not going to take it back. Gee whiz, I can't possibly spend this money. It'll have to be in the very same kind of a cause, bringing world together, that we care about each other and we can make things that never, ever happened before happen.
So you brought people from different countries together through music and other ways, and promoting peace and the idea that we can have peace in the world. That's really wonderful.
Yeah. And then lots of doing and spending your own money and everything. I decided to use a lawyer and accountant with the purpose and a mission for nuclear disarmament. And nuclear disarmament is a very deepest desire of every Hiroshima survivor, that we don't want anything like this ever, ever to happen to anyone else.
Okay. Yeah, I understand. Great work. Could you tell us very briefly what the Green Legacy Hiroshima is and how your organization is involved in that? I find that a very interesting project.
Yes, it's a revived Hiroshima tree. After the bomb, they said for 75 years, nothing will grow. And tons of trees we lost. On the other hand, when the spring came, some trees started to grow a little new bud. And we realized it wasn't completely dead. Many, many places, but especially like in the Hiroshima Arboretum, which is not too far from the center of Ground Zero, where lots and lots of people died. They went to the garden to rest and never rose, expired. It meant a lot to us. And Green Legacy Hiroshima people collected the seeds from these revived trees and made available for us to plant. Michael Oxendine germinated. And then publicity guy for the Department of Agriculture from the Salem, James Garsbeck, saw germinating and asked, what are these? And he said, oh, these are coming from the seeds from Hiroshima. And Garsbeck's eyes lighted up. Oh, wow. Between the two of them, they planted all over Oregon. The state of Oregon really has very foresight and compassionate people. I'm impressed. And they found places and communities where Green Legacy Hiroshima wanted the tree to grow as a friendship and with a sign of hope and reconciliation. So we made a QR code, you know, with the history of Hiroshima and what this could do and what we OSDI wants people to focus on.
So basically you took the seeds from these trees that people thought would never grow again, but they did. And the seeds, did they go to other places besides Oregon? Did they go?
Yes. Because, you know, I've lectured at different university places before the pandemic. I sent them to peace and justice campuses in Pennsylvania, North Carolina, Duke University. But one I'm most proud of is there's one growing in a school with learning disability in Pennsylvania. Can you imagine? I couldn't have found a place if I hiked around Pennsylvania. But the founder of the school was the mother of OSDI finance officer.
Okay. What a great legacy for such a tragedy to have something like that to grow. That's very wonderful symbolism. You know, you're such an inspiration to people who have been through hard times, and you seem to have a lot of gratitude for your life now. And we have a lot of gratitude that you are here today, and you've done so many good things with your life, considering how it started. So we just want to thank you very much for being here today.
But it's with your support, God's grace. The grace of God made it possible. Thank you so much.
You're so welcome. Yes, we have come to the close of today's show. Thank you so much for the work you do towards peace, telling your story of Hiroshima, and helping spread awareness. It was really hard not to cry as you told your very emotional experiences. And thanks to all of you out there for being with us today. This is Aspen Green with Kathy Harris on Broad Perspectives Radio. You can learn more on our Broad Perspectives Radio page at kxci.org. Stick around right now, because next up we have Boom Goddess Radio with Jennifer Davis Page. Enjoy your Sunday, and we'll see you next week. And we're going to go out with the song All My Trials. It's sung by Joan Baez. The lyrics of All My Trials tell the story of a mother on her deathbed, comforting her children. But as with all spirituals, there's a deeper message. In this case, that no matter how bleak the situation seems, the struggle will be over.